to Banking Matters. I'm your host, Roger Morris. Today, I am pleased to welcome Kurt Steven. Kurt is a bankruptcy attorney in the McAllen, Texas area. He is a graduate of the University of Texas School of Law and a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of the University of Texas. He brings to the podcast decades of experience in bankruptcy law and has served in various roles with the local and regional bar associations and is a frequent speaker on bankruptcy issues. Also of note for us here at Compliance Alliance, he is the father of our very own Victoria Steven. And, you know, Kurt, you might imagine I've gotten plenty of question requests from my coworkers, but I figured we will steer clear of those and we will focus on bankruptcy law and you. So to start, we always like to ask our guests, how do they get into banking? But in your case, how did you get into law and later bankruptcy law?
Well, I can tell you about how I got into bankruptcy law really easily. I came to work for a 5-member law firm here in McAllen, as you said, decades ago. And being the lowest lawyer on the totem pole, things rolled downhill. And everything the other people did not want to do, I did. So that meant whenever there were federal criminal appointments, we were allowed to substitute one lawyer for another in a law firm. So I'd go do the federal criminal trials. I did a murder trial, arbitration. That would roll downhill. So I did an arbitration on 100 ostrich eggs that were purchased on the ground in South Africa. And when they got to Austin, Texas, they wouldn't hatch. They were supposed to hatch. So we had an arbitration about that and many things. But bankruptcy was on the list of things nobody wanted to do because they didn't understand it. All they knew was, you can really mess it up if you don't know what you're doing, and it has lots of rules and deadlines. So, yeah, so that's how I got into bankruptcy, and I ended up really liking it.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating area of the law. I did a little bit of it in private practice myself, and when I got into my role at Compliance Alliance, it's really a confusing area for banks, loan officers, compliance officers. It's really kind of a foreign language to them outside of their area of expertise. And when I was talking with you about the best way to communicate about bankruptcy law with our listeners, you had a really interesting idea about how to frame it. So I think today, as we go through the podcast, we'll be talking as if we're talking to a loan officer who for the first time is encountering a customer who is going through a bankruptcy. So I guess first, the best place to start is going to be just, what is bankruptcy law? Is it a federal law, state law? Just a high-level overview to begin.
Well, I think the first thing I would want to tell the young loan officer is don't be intimidated by all the chapter numbers and rules and confusion about where the jurisdiction comes from and so forth. Just sort of step away, back away from it, and understand that bankruptcy is a federal law that comes in and basically says, we want to try to figure out a way to give a fresh start to honest debtors who are in over their head. They can't pay all their debts. And quite frankly, it's a mess. So we're going to try to have a system that sorts it all out, does the best job in a bad situation, maximizes value of assets, prioritizes who gets paid from the liquidation of those assets, and distributes it in some fair manner, and ends the process. So let's everybody move on. The debtor moves on, the court moves on, the loan officer moves on with other files. So, I mean, that's what it's all about.
You know, I think it's you mentioned this too. It's important to just kind of humanize it a little bit on the banks. And it's very easy to like see that someone filed for bankruptcy and be thinking about all the additional responsibilities or be worrying about what you need to do so that you're in compliance. But this is someone who's at the end of the rope here and trying to work their way through the system. And so you mentioned the different bankruptcy chapters. This is something we get questions on the Compliance Alliance hotline all the time. What does Chapter 7 mean, 11? Sure. Could you dive into that a little for the areas that might affect banks the most.
Sure. So really everything starts with Chapter 7. Chapter 7 is what's called straight bankruptcy, liquidation bankruptcy. Bankruptcy starts with the United States Constitution. It provided for Congress to set up bankruptcy laws for the situation we just talked about. And Chapter 7 was the first bankruptcy law, and it's basically a straight liquidation. You file a set of schedules, which are lists of your assets and lists of your liabilities. You file another thing called the Statement of Financial Affairs, which answers certain questions like, have you made any transfers to family members in the previous 2 years, 1 year? So with those sworn answers and your sworn statements of what you owe and what you own, then the process starts to sort out how are those assets going to get sold, who's going to sell them, and who gets paid for those assets. So a trustee, and we're going to come back to the word trustee, but a Chapter 7 trustee is what I call a full-blown trustee. And that means the trustee actually owns the assets of the debtor upon filing a bankruptcy. And the trustee is charged with liquidating those assets, selling them for the best possible price, and then paying out the proceeds to the creditors and determining which creditors have priority, which ones get paid first. So that's the liquidation process. That's Chapter 7. That's straight bankruptcy. But all the other bankruptcies, think of them in terms of you start with the Chapter 7 concept. And I say that because all the other bankruptcy chapters, they all have a provision in them that say that in the other chapters, the creditors are going to get at least what they would have gotten had this been a Chapter 7 liquidating bankruptcy. So that's why Chapter 7 is the basis, because gotcha. When you get to the other chapters, you're always going to have a test to see if Chapter 7 would be better for creditors than one of the other chapters. So you want me to move on to the reorganization chapters?
Yeah, let's hear about Chapter 11.
All right. Well, that's kind of the first one and the biggest one and the basic one. But Chapter 11, reorganization, says, all right, creditors, you're going to come out better if we don't liquidate all the assets. For example, you got a restaurant. And so, yeah, we can sell all the pots and pans and the stove and the chairs, and here's how much you're going to get. Not very much. But if we reorganize, if you let us continue working, here's how we're going to change. We're going to have fewer employees. We're going to work harder. We're going to cut our costs of inventory coming in, and we're going to raise our prices. And our customers have said they'll still come eat here. So out of future profits, we're going to pay, according to a plan, an amount of money that is going to end up being more than you would have gotten had we liquidated the pots and pans. So it's a really effective bankruptcy chapter. It's used all the time. And we tend to think of it as reorganization rather than just calling it a bankruptcy, because it really is redoing the way you're gonna pay your debts. So a couple of things I want to say about Chapter 11 before we talk about Chapter 13.
Okay.
Chapter 11 always has a plan. And a reorganization plan, think of it as a new contract. as a new contract between the borrower, the debtor, in our case, the bank, the bank's notes and the bank's loans can be and almost always are renegotiated in terms of how long the payment term is going to be. So a major change from Chapter 7 is you do not have a trustee appointed. And this is where, I guess, one of the forks in the road where people start getting confused right away. The trustee is a new entity called a DIP, a debtor in possession. And that is the same debtor that filed the bankruptcy. So, you know, let's go back to the restaurant example. You know, if it's Roger Morris's Hamburger Joint LLC that filed the reorganization bankruptcy, well, Roger Morris is going to be the debtor representative of the LLC, and Roger Morris is going to be the debtor in possession. And that's a big deal, because now you're not just the pre-bankruptcy individual, you are clothed with certain bankruptcy rights and powers, and you're also clothed with bankruptcy obligations. And the debtor in possession acts as the trustee. And so powers of the trustee, for example, to set aside pre-petition conveyances, let's say that your restaurant owned a vehicle, a car, and it was paying for a very nice Land Rover. And before bankruptcy, you made a bad decision to convey that Land Rover to your buddy. Well, that may be a fraudulent transfer. And so now in your new role as the debtor in possession, you're obligated to bring an action to set aside that transfer and bring that vehicle back into your bankruptcy estate. So Chapter 11 reorganizes. It does it without a trustee initially. There's cases, of course, where if you don't do your job, a trustee can be appointed by the court, another trustee, or you can be converted to Chapter 7 liquidation because you're not reorganizing according to the rules.
If you're a debtor too, I would imagine that would be preferable. You'd want to have more control of your assets and how the process goes. Is that typically the case?
Let's be real honest here. I mean, typically what happens is, especially a small debtor has the idea that if I just have a chance, I can make this work. So there's always an optimism. Let's put it that way. There's always an optimism that Chapter 7 is going to be the vehicle by which I get out of all these problems. And the truthful answer is that's true, and it's going to work so long as your business actually works from here forward. As long as it generates enough income that you can pay your ongoing employees, you can pay your accruing ad valorem taxes, property taxes, you can pay your accruing fees of the bankruptcy court, you can pay your inventory. As long as your business works, you have a chance that Chapter 11 is going to reorganize your business. Your creditors will vote for your plan because they're convinced they're going to be better off not liquidating under Chapter 7. And that's the answer. If the business works, then yeah, it has a good chance of working. As you can imagine, if the business doesn't work to start with, Chapter 11 is not going to save you.
Gotcha. Well, that makes complete sense. I guess the other chapter that seems to come up in this context is chapter 13. Can you provide a brief explanation of chapter 13?
Yeah, chapter 13, number one, it's only for individuals. So the entities like we talked about, an LLC or a corporation, cannot use chapter 13. Chapter 13 is for individuals to reorganize their consumer debts. That's an important word. They have to have mainly consumer debts to be qualified for Chapter 13. And the process tends to be very administrative. And by that, I mean the plan that you file in a Chapter 13 is already an existing promulgated plan. It's a plan that the judges of the different districts around the country have come up with as their standard Chapter 13 plan that they use. And they hold seminars and they make sure that all the bankruptcy Chapter 13 practitioners, the lawyers, the paralegals, everybody understands what the plan means. Everybody knows what it works. The changes to the plan tend to be by check the box type changes. So you have an individual consumer. He's had some hospital bills. He's been laid off from his job. But now he has a job. He has income. He's required to have what's called regular income. That can be Social Security, it could be disability, it could be anything that's regular income. And with that income, it goes through a process called a means test, which basically means what are you able to pay? What is your disposable income? And there's a test for each area and the size of your family. This is what is allowed for you to live on, and what is above that amount is disposable income, and you pay the disposable income into a plan, generally 5-year plan, and there's a test that says, yeah, with this 5 years of disposable income, this consumer debtor can pay a certain percentage to his creditors, and he's passed those tests, he's passed those milestones, and his plan gets confirmed, and that's his new relationship for the next 5 years. The trustee. The Chapter 13 trustee is not exactly like the liquidation Chapter 7 trustee. The Chapter 13 trustee, think of more as this is the court-approved system operator who's going to receive the monthly disposable income paid in by the debtor, is going to categorize the creditors and how they're entitled to get paid, and then is actually going to pay the money to the creditors. And the trustee, Chapter 13 trustee's job is, and if the debtor is falling behind and unable to perform according to his plan, then the trustee comes back to the court and says, this case needs to be dismissed or it needs to be converted to a liquidation.
Gotcha. Okay, well, that all makes sense. I really appreciate that high-level overview of the different chapters. I think that'll really clear the air for a lot of our listeners here. But if I'm the loan officer in this situation, there's a couple other buzzwords, so to speak, that keep coming up, and maybe you can define these for me. The first I want to go over is the automatic stay.
Yeah, that's the first one they need to be aware of, because if they got a debtor that isn't paying, and if they've started their foreclosure process or repossession process or demand letters or litigation, the automatic stay says you got to stop doing that immediately. And it's very serious because a couple of things. Sometimes I've heard over the years, well, we didn't get any kind of official notice of the bankruptcy. Well, that doesn't matter. I mean, if you have any kind of notice or inkling that there could be a bankruptcy, you need to run the public access on PACER and find out if your debtor has filed bankruptcy or not. If you have any kind of notice of bankruptcy, you must stop immediately. You don't need any kind of official notice. And stop means really stop. It means if you're repossessing the car and he's halfway to the bank on the wrecker car, he may as well turn around and take the car back because that's what's going to happen. And you don't want to knowingly violate any aspect of the stay because there are requirements of the bankruptcy court that the court impose dollar sanctions, in our case, on the bank for knowingly violating the stay. So just don't do it.
Gotcha. That's really important for banks to know. You know, a lot of times in the banking context, that collection, the FDCPA comes up, and when banks collect in their own name, it does not apply for the most part. So knowing that you still need to watch out for automatic stays, this is a completely separate thing to consider is very important. I guess moving on, the next buzzword I wanted to go over was discharge. You've already touched on that a little bit.
Yeah. So discharge is 100% a bankruptcy word that almost encapsulates the whole system, because every bankruptcy has as its goal obtaining a debtor discharge, because the discharge is a federal court order that says you are discharged from all your dischargeable debts. Well, that's what you sought to do when you filed your bankruptcy petition. And I'll say as an aside, if that's not what you're seeking, If you're a debtor and you don't think you can get a discharge for one of the reasons we can talk about, then you may as well not file a bankruptcy in the first place, because the system is going to get you in trouble. And the only reason to be in bankruptcy is to get that discharge. So the discharge says, it's a simple order that comes down from the court. It's basically a page or two long, and it says you are discharged from your dischargeable debts, and then it explains a little bit about what might not be discharged. And as an aside there, it's basically things like taxes. It's the discharge order did not discharge your income tax liability. It does not discharge automatically things like that the federal system calls DSO, domestic support obligation. In the different states, they may call it child support, alimony, spousal support, property settlement, a lot of things, but those are automatically not discharged. You are still responsible for those even after you have a discharge. So that's probably enough overview of discharge, but I want to contrast it with the word dismissal, because I have clients that come in all the time and say, I have a situation, somebody owed me money, but he was dismissed in bankruptcy, so I understand he doesn't have to pay me anymore. And of course, that's using the word dismissal when they mean discharge. And that's the first thing that we have to check out. If you mean, did he get discharged? Is there a discharge order? Then yes, he doesn't have to pay you anymore. But if you mean dismissed, he filed a bankruptcy, but the case got dismissed, well, that just reverts him to his pre-bankruptcy state, and he does still owe you the money. So,
gotcha. A very important distinction.
That may be
there.
Overkill on the difference in the two words, but that's a very important distinction.
No, I think that's very important to know. I guess moving along here, if I'm the loan officer in this scenario we described, and I get word that one of our customers has filed for bankruptcy, What should the first couple of steps be here? I mean, I'm assuming one of the first steps is going to be looping in legal, but what should the banker, the bank do together in tandem?
Well, first, I would look at deadlines. I'd make myself an outline, and I would figure out, where am I at in this thing? What kind of bankruptcy did they file? And if they, let's say they filed a Chapter 11. So the first thing you want to know, again, is be cognizant of deadlines. So you're going to have a proof of claim deadline. I can come back to proofs of claim, but we're going to go down the list of what I think the officer ought to do. So I've got a proof of claim deadline. I need to see what that is, and I need to see what I got to do by that deadline. There's this thing called the creditors meeting. I may as well plan on going to that, because the creditor is required to do it, is required to be under oath. And I get a chance as a creditor to ask questions under oath. So I need to avail myself of that opportunity. Then there's other things. There's deadlines on the debtor is claiming exempt property. I need to make sure that an exempt property does not get paid to creditors. So I need to make sure that I don't have an issue with what the debtor is claiming as his exempt property. There's also deadlines. If I think the debtor has done something wrong, if I think, for example, giving a inflated loan application, or, you know, inflating his assets on a loan application. Let's take that one for an example. If you really, and I'll give you an example of how that can come about. Let's say a loan officer is sitting there looking at a financial statement that says the debtor owns a ranch at Pedernales and it's worth $1 million. And then the debtor files sworn schedules and he doesn't list this ranch. It's not in his bankruptcy schedules. Well, that's a problem for the debtor and a problem for the banker. If the bank relied on the financial statement and the debtor is now saying, yeah, but I don't own that ranch anymore. I transferred it, you know, to my brother-in-law. Well, now you've got another deadline to look at. You've got a deadline of, well, what is the time period for the bank to bring its action to, you know, set aside that fraudulent transfer. So to sort of recap, the first thing I would do is go over my loan file, go over the debtor has to file his schedules and statement of financial affairs promptly within 5 days of filing the bankruptcy. So get them, read them. And when things don't look right, things don't stack up, you need to be aware of, okay, I need to have a calendar here of when's my proof of claim, when's my deadline on exempt property, when's my deadline for fraudulent transfers, when is my creditors meeting, and get organized on what I'm going to do with my file.
Gotcha. And we're starting to run out of time here, but before we get any further, I do want to go over the proof of claim in a little bit more detail, because that's going to be so important for the creditor to file. Can you discuss that a little bit, the steps, what goes into those?
Yeah, the proof of claim, number one, the form is a national form. A bankruptcy, of course, is federal, and it's the same rules and the same form everywhere in the country. And the proof, let's take a proof of claim form in a Chapter 7 first. Here's the important parts of it. You need to make sure that you attach to the proof of claim how you calculated what you are owed, including things like how much of this is accrued interest, how much is it default rate accrued interest, how much of it is administrative fees like attorney's fees, how much of it is some other type of fees that you may be charged, late fees. All those have to be included in your calculation. And you must attach documents that support it. So if you have a note and a deed of trust and a loan history, you attach all of that because you don't want your proof of claim objected to because you failed to attach the necessary documents. I'll just briefly touch on in every bankruptcy, because this is real important to bankers. Outside of bankruptcy, you're owed $1 million and you've got a lien on some pots and pans and a restaurant location. And it's a single debt, a single amount of money owed, and a single set of collateral. But once bankruptcy is filed, your claim is going to be bifurcated into, well, a portion of your claim may be secured because of the value of the pots and pans in the real estate. But a portion, if you're undersecured, then your undersecured claim is an unsecured claim. So you actually have two claims. You have a secured and an unsecured, and they're going to be treated differently in the bankruptcy process. Now, you don't have to worry about that too much in the proof of claim. It's not your job at that point to try to figure all that out, but you do have to list what your collateral is, and the proof of claim is filed under penalties of perjury, and there are, I think, a $500,000 fine for knowingly filing a proof of claim that you know is not truthful. So it's a serious process, and you need to make sure it's done right, and it has to be done on time. Your notice of filing that comes from the clerk generally has a proof of claim deadline in it. I say generally because in Chapter 11, it generally will. In Chapter 7, sometimes it will not have a deadline because if it is considered at filing a no asset case, meaning there's not going to be any assets to be liquidated to creditors. So therefore, there's no point filing a proof of claim because you're not getting anything. If those situations change and it turns out assets are available, then there will be a new notice sending a new proof of claim deadline. But you got to file by the proof of claim deadline. You have to know when it is. You got to attach all your docs.
Gotcha. And I want to touch on one more thing before we close out here. Just not even in the bankruptcy context, in the debt collection process, it's so important to perfect your lien that establishes lien priority. I'm assuming here in the bankruptcy context, the lien priority kind of works out the same way. What debtors or what creditors get paid is going to depend on their priority of liens. Can you speak to that for a second?
Absolutely. And I'll parse words with you a little bit on priority. Let's call it secured and unsecured. Okay.
Sure.
So you want to make sure you're oversecured. That's your goal as a banker, is to be oversecured. You've got more collateral than the debtor owes you. When you're oversecured, you're in good shape in bankruptcy because you're allowed to get over time all your money plus interest plus your attorney's fees. You get the whole thing if you're oversecured. If you're undersecured, you're not treated as well at all. Your secured portion gets paid the secured portion, but it does not accrue interest. You do not get your attorney's fees, and your unsecured portion may be treated at just pennies on the dollar. So you want to, pre-bankruptcy, if you think one is on the horizon, you want to shore up your loan if you can. Now, there's deadlines on that too. Basically, think of 90 days. That's the cutoff date. If within 90 days before bankruptcy, you bootstrap your loan that had an unsecured, what would be an unsecured portion in bankruptcy, you get another piece of land to secure your loan, that's a good move. If you do it within 90 days of the filing of bankruptcy, it's not going to hold up. It's going to get set aside. If you do it 91 days before bankruptcy, you did it. You get to keep that upgrade of your portfolio. So, yeah, important. I'll come back to the word priority. Priority in bankruptcy terms is reserved for unsecured creditors. So we've talked about, as a bank, you've got a secured portion that gets paid. Your unsecured portion is going to be subject to a cascading level of who gets paid first. And that's what priority means. So high priority is the bankruptcy system itself, including the Chapter 7 trustee, taxes. All of these things are ahead of the bank's unsecured portion. Think of it as it's pretty much the bottom of the barrel, only above equity holders. But the priorities pay taxes and administrative fees before the bank gets paid on its unsecured claim.
Gotcha. Well, very important for bankers to know. Well, Kurt, I really appreciate having you on. I think we've reached the end of our time, but before we head out, we always like to ask our guests if they have one piece of parting advice for our viewers.
You know, I think I kind of already covered it. I mean, if I'm a loan officer and I have a Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing, I mean, don't be intimidated. Don't be afraid. Don't be, you know, I'm a fish out of water. Understand your loan file. Understand where you are. Understand your collateral in real terms. If you got land, understand what you think it's really worth in today's market selling it. If you've got other sorts of collateral, know what you think the valuation is. Look at your entire loan relationship. Look at what you were told in financial statements and any written statement to the bank as to what supported making this loan in the first place. And if some of those things are not panning out and don't seem to be true now, you need to be able to communicate to your next step, your advisor, what you believe about that. And then be constantly aware that I can't back off from this. I've got deadlines that are going to be running, and go ahead and start writing them down. You know, these are my deadlines. This is my time frame. This thing moves on like a train, and these deadlines are going to happen. They're going to come and go. So you have to be ready for them.
Gotcha. Well, I couldn't agree more. I really appreciate you taking the time. I think this was a great overview of bankruptcy law. I think our viewers will get a lot of value out of it. And to everyone else out there, that's Banking Matters.